Morals and Politics. The National Association of Educational Broadcasters, in cooperation with the Cooper Union and radio station WNYC, New York City, presents another in a tape-recorded series of programs from the Cooper Union Forum. The subject of our series, Morals and Politics. To introduce this week's speaker, here is the chairman of the Cooper Union Forum, Professor Johnson E. Fairchild.
And the subheading in this series of talks is entitled Great Problems. The number one problem, educating for democracy, which is the subject for our discussion. Our speaker is Dr. H. Gordon Hullfish, professor of Ohio State University. Dr. Hullfish has been chairman of the Commission of Educational Freedom, the visiting lecturer at Ohio State University, Harvard University, and of all places, City College of New York. Has been a new education fellow in the University of Hawaii and in California, member of the board of directors of the Social Frontier, editor of the Educational Freedom in an Age of Anxiety. That's very wonderful. Dr. Hullfish is much more than that. He is a very human and very wonderful educator, interested in the educational frontiers and democracy and transition in the community schools, education, freedom, and democracy. We're very much honored that Dr. Hullfish has come here from Columbus, Ohio, to speak to us tonight. Dr. Gordon Hullfish.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, this Cooper Union audience, I am honored to have been asked to come to your platform and am indeed very pleased that my schedule made it possible for me to be here at this time. This topic, educating for democracy, is, I think, certainly no simple one, and I speak to it without any sense of complete adequacy. Let me say that I know of no simple answer to the question, what education will best serve a democratic people? Few problems within a democracy, subject as they are to consideration by all of the people, are readily or permanently solved. Education is no exception. The totalitarians face a simpler problem in constructing an appropriate education. They have only to design an educational machine which the machine operators, the teachers, will service. The intricacies of the machine and the resulting character of the service may need to be changed from time to time, but this is a top office decision, so to speak, one in which the operators are no more involved than are the machines. A democracy dare not come at its problems in this way, though some of the more fanatical educational critics and indeed some educational officials act on occasion as if theirs were a top office responsibility. But this is only to say that one of the luxuries democracies have long indulged in has been to permit some citizens to demonstrate publicly the inappropriateness of their ideas and of their behavior. How far we dare to indulge ourselves in this direction is a pertinent question, though we need not pursue it here. If there is no simple answer, there are some factors, nevertheless, that may be marked off as essential elements to any full consideration of the problem. And obvious as it may be to say this, the public school must be noted as the ground in which the democratic aspiration is rooted generation by generation. I will not say that schools other than public fail to provide a ground in which these roots take hold. I must say, however, that were we without public schools, the tendencies among us toward divisiveness would be accentuated dangerously. We should have to find a way to invent such schools. Fortunately for us, our forebears wanted no man to have unwarranted advantages over others on education or any other score, and in their wisdom evolved a public instrument of enlightenment and significantly of association. And I think we do not call attention sufficiently to the fact of the consequence of association of peoples, young people, by virtue of the fact that we do have the public school. And I would like to read here a little news item that I came across in what I suppose might be called a gossipy column, written by Leonard Lyons back in July 1952. I thought it was quite significant, really, as it bears upon this problem. This is what it said. He was writing from Paris. He said, the New York City Center Ballet is ending its Paris run and moving on to London. The ballet came here as part of the 20th Century Art Festival. The critics to whom I spoke all agreed that the four Americans easily ran away with the festival and that their contributions were the most popular. Which four Americans, I asked, and was told, Balanchine, Nabokov, Leonidov, and Stravinsky. And here, it seems to me, you have summed up in four words. One of the great characteristics of this instrument, which is public education. I say it is an instrument not merely of enlightenment, but of association. I can point to no charts, to no statistical tables to prove the point. Yet a claim that our public schools, opening their doors as they do year in and year out to the children of each neighborhood, asking only that residents as of the moment be established, have been the greatest single force in building whatever sense of oneness, of togetherness we have achieved. This claim, I say, is hardly open to challenge. I can point, of course, to our failure in some neighborhoods to be neighborly. Some of our children have been denied the enriching experience, or better perhaps the democratic right, of maturing in situations where they could share their interests and emerging values freely with the interests and values of all the children of the neighborhood. The Supreme Court has now made this denial a matter of public record, labeling it for what it has always been, a failure to live up to our commitment of our heritage, a failure to educate for democracy. But there is another side of this situation which is not so obvious, one not dramatized by court decision. The deprivation of some children of a freely shared experience with others in any neighborhood, from small town to the nation as a whole, is in fact a deprivation of all children. Our chance of living together with understanding in our adult years is directly proportionate to the opportunity afforded us to develop a sense of togetherness as we mature. Private and parochial schools, while they may not be undemocratic, either in conception or in practice, will have more difficulty than do public schools in meeting the responsibility for combating divisive tendencies which both schools share. What all of us need to remember is that children in a democracy should share their growth as they share the sidewalks, as pathways to common adventures. where they may meet to play together and to plan together, where they may jostle one another as pathways cross, where they may go their separate ways, where they may deny to none the right of use. Woodrow Wilson was not thinking primarily about public education, though he was thinking deeply about the future of democracy when he remarked, "We overlook the fact that the real source of strength in the community comes from the bottom." Pursuing this thought, he asked, "Do you find democracy renewing itself from the top? Don't you find society renewing itself from the ranks of unknown men? Do you look to the leading families to go on leading you? Do you look to the ranks of men already established in authority to contribute sons to lead the next generation? They may. Sometimes they do, but you can't count on them. And what you are constantly depending on is the rise out of the ranks of unknown men, the emergence of somebody from some place of which you had thought the least, of some man unanointed from on high, to do the thing that the generation calls for. Who would have looked to see Lincoln save a nation? All the while, there was springing up in him, as if he were connected with the very soil itself, the sap of a nation, the vision of a great people, a sympathy so ingrained and intimate with the common run of men that he was like the people impersonated, sublimated, touched with genius. And it is to such sources that we must always look. But Wilson was thinking of public education when he said, "You know that the great melting pot of America, the place where we are all made Americans of, is the public school, where men of every race and of every origin and of every station in life send their children, or ought to send their children, and where, being mixed together, the youngsters are all infused with the American spirit and developed into American men and American women." Before leaving either this point or Woodrow Wilson, we should note that the function of the public school in providing an education for democracy is not restricted to the children, any more than education is restricted to the immature years. No society ever suffered from an excess of knowledge or intelligence, or from an oversupply of understanding shared by its citizens. A democracy strengthens itself as it makes gains in each of these directions, and the citizens in the institution which is the public school possess an instrument to strengthen themselves and their common life. Education, as is true of democracy itself, is never a thing done, but, as Archibald MacLeish has phrased it, a thing a doing. Thus Woodrow Wilson noted that when, in addition to sending our children to school to paid teachers, we go to school to one another in those same schoolhouses, then we shall begin more fully to realize than we have ever realized before what American life is. Quite specifically, he pointed to his participation in this forum as giving him the assurance that this was so. It was against the background of an early experience of his at Cooper Union that he said, "And what I like about this social center idea of the schoolhouse is that there is the place where the ordinary fella is going to get his innings, going to ask his questions, going to express his opinions, going to convince those who do not realize that the vigor of America pulses in the blood of every true American, and that the only place he can find the true American is in this clearinghouse of absolutely democratic opinion. A nation which develops education widely, involving many of its citizens and all of its future citizens in its program, has provided itself with an assurance that it will not stand still, that its life will almost certainly improve. And this is so even when the purpose of education is admittedly to maintain the status quo. Ideas beget ideas. They stir the imagination of those who entertain them. Whenever we permit the examination of some ideas, we open the possibility that ideas which hold no permit will confront the thinker and ask to be heard. It is no accident that parents, in small and private ways, withhold some ideas from their children, being fearful that if certain implications come into view, the children will go on to speculate about ideas the parents would like to hold back for a later day, if not forever. Nor is it an accident that organizations and institutions behave identically on a large scale and publicly. But over the long haul, the censor fights a losing battle. Thus, we may hope that the communist world, if the figure is not inappropriate, presently has a bear by the tail. If the communists are to be the force in our time they clearly wish to be, they will need citizens as knowledgeable and as skilled as our citizens in any other parts of the world. No other road to survival is open to any nation in our complex scientific and technological present. Every demand upon the communists, therefore, that they extend their knowledge in whatever area is equally a demand that the diligence of the security police be extended. So it is that the purge and the public apology for having thought wrongly are becoming familiar features of communist life, but also so it is that ideas are extended and reconstructed even as the intention is that they remain static until such time as an order permitting or demanding change is given. Now, our repressive critics, and we have some, are but faint counterparts of these security police. And so long as we retain our devotion to open discussion, to the free examination of ideas, they are reduced to the nuisance level of the horsefly. Yet we had better bestir ourselves whenever the self-appointed censor gains the slightest measure of governmental backing. It is at this point, of course, that we find the critical test of how well we are doing in educating for democracy. We can put aside for the moment, almost as irrelevant, the many current arguments about what specifically we are teaching and how well. The anecdotes that the critics regale us with about the young men and women they have met who cannot spell are interesting, yet they are unrelated to the main issue. This is equally true of the counter-argument, namely that test results show present students to be learning the fundamentals as well as did students in an earlier day, and frequently better. I am not suggesting that we should fail to teach well whatever we select as fundamental. Few of us ever know enough. This is true even of those who find it profitable to tell the rest of us of our lacks. What I do wish to suggest is that the critical factor is the atmosphere that pervades and surrounds the learning situation. Democracy makes no gain, No matter how well the basic tools of learning are taught, if teachers and students are caught up in an atmosphere of fear, suspicion, and repression. That such an atmosphere has prevailed for a number of years, and that it has had serious consequences for education, we well know. Each of us has his anecdotes on this score too. My latest comes from the chairman of a large department in a liberal arts college in a great university. He was seeking an instructor to add to the staff. One letter that recommended a young man highly made note of his years of study and experience, of the character and range of his scholarship, of his personality, and of his promise as a teacher. But then, was he perhaps throwing an anchor to the windward? But then the writer said of his candidate that while he had a broad social point of view, he was in no sense a radical. We have more than anecdote to go on, however. We have the fact of the harassment of individual teachers and school systems the country over by those who would use the limitations of their own minds as the limits of growth for the minds of others. The atmosphere has not been good. It has not encouraged our best efforts to animate the educative process by keeping always to the fore the spirit of that free-wheeling intelligence on which the democratic aspiration feeds. Yet, in my opinion, the atmosphere is improving. We are getting our second wind. The shine is beginning to rub off the senator. We are discovering that free people will not gain security when they deny the institution by which they renew themselves generation by generation its right to be free. Democracy is in need of the best informed thought and of the best disposed thought that the genius of the people can generate. About these ends, when stated thus, little difference arises among us. We find most men to be for the free mind and for the generous heart, about as readily as Calvin Coolidge found them to be against sin. Differences appear only when we construct the educative means to foster these ends, quite as differences arise when men set out to check sin. Actually, of course, the differences go beyond means, beyond instrumentalities. There are some who are sure that the best informed thought and the best motivated conduct stand in some duplicating relationship to standards which reside beyond time and place and thus beyond men. There are others, John Dewey was one of these, who believe that it is within time and place and circumstance that standards for thought and conduct are developed and the tests of their adequacy found. There are those who believe, therefore, that man lives under the guidance of absolute standards and that education ought to bring him to an understanding of this fact. There are others, again, Mr. Dewey was of this company, who believe that men are capable of generating the standards and ideals by which to guide their thought and conduct. And there are those, to narrow the discussion somewhat, who seem to believe that all that is wrong with modern education is that John Dewey lived. And in the living, convinced others that the philosophy he evolved was meaningful for the improvement of life in general and for the improvement of education specifically. Some of those convinced do use what Douglas Bush of Harvard has recently referred to as John Dewey's philosophy of barbarism as a point of orientation in planning programs for the education of teachers, and in consequence, so it is held, the true purposes of education have been subverted. It does seem to me at times that some critics of education resemble that habit-ridden citizen who, come what may, is determined to defeat Franklin Delano Roosevelt each time he casts a ballot. But be this as it may, the differences in outlook are facts of our times. They are not to be laughed away, nor, as I see it, are they to be reconciled. I think we have spent enough time trying to find the common elements in our differing views, knowing all the while that the uncommon element, the element that made for the difference in the first instance, would not be under scrutiny. What we have to ask ourselves is whether our differences have brought us to the end of the road, reducing us to the pathetic gesture of calling the other fellow barbaric while seeing naught but the acme of civilization in our own mirrors. I do not believe that we are at the end of the road, though I do believe that the pathway we have been following leads but to frustration and unnecessary bickering. Our democratic experience ought to be more useful to us than we have permitted it to be. We are not without experience in developing unity as we have clarified differences, even deepened them. Let me be quite specific. On the issue presented above, I stand with John Dewey. I will not say that those of other persuasions are wrong. I will only say that I think they are. In some specific instances, I believe that some who differ are ill-informed. And I must believe further that where this is so, the discovery of this fact would have the same impact upon their views as a comparable discovery should have on mine. But where does this leave us? In a democracy, since neither camp has the authority to abolish the other, it should leave us each first with the right to believe as he does, and second, insofar as any of us has responsibility for the education of others, with the responsibility to gain supporting evidence for the practices we advocate. Nostalgia, we should note, is not a substitute for evidence, nor is the niggling use of anecdote a substitute for reasoned conclusions. Our schools will not become adept in educating for democracy as long as those of us who try to give them direction fail to understand its meaning for our own behavior. There are several reasons why we have not done better than we have, including the limitation each of us confronts in his own person. Education has changed as the needs of the nation have changed. It has changed as the trend toward urban life made rural character a thing of the past. It has changed as the nature and character and purposes of those who seek it have changed. It has changed as the nature and character and purposes of those who provide it have changed. It has changed as knowledge. The knowledge the schools are asked to transmit, as well as the knowledge of what is involved in the act of transmission, has changed. It has changed as the place of our nation and a concert of nations has changed, and as in the process our obligations and the conditions of our security have changed. The wonder is not that education has been under criticism. The wonder is that it gained such obvious vitality while undergoing one growing pain after another. But there is yet another reason, one that takes me back to my standing ground, my point of difference with those who stand otherwise. Each of us finds his standing ground good, and from it expects to give order and meaning to all that he touches, including education. From it, we each move towards system, towards substance, labeling the result a philosophy of life, a philosophy of education, or more simply, yet perhaps more forcefully, a way of life. Thus, we move toward inclusiveness, preparing ourselves better all the while to fend off those of other persuasions. If we have done our task well, we shall have no difficulty in showing, when we come to education, that whatever the other fellow proposes or does is, on the face, wrong. It is in these terms that one of John Dewey's critics has said, in effect, that even if Mr. Dewey's pedagogical proposals were correct, so far as enhancing learning is concerned, he would reject them. It is paradoxical that the excluding potential of each point of view is raised as each advances toward inclusiveness. I am reminded of a favorite remark of my former colleague, Boyd H. Boda, when he said the trouble with the university professor is that he identifies the university with the universe. As soon as we turn to the social scene, and all who think about education must do this, the problem appears in clearer focus, though the difficulty of dealing with it is perhaps increased. Many who would lay no claim to having a philosophy or to having formulated a philosophy of education would tend to recognize a personal commitment in the phrasing, the democratic way of life, and would anticipate, now that they feel themselves to be aware of competing ways of life, that our school should advance the democratic way. This seems reasonable, and many have been and are involved in setting forth its pattern, at ease with their conviction that in doing so, they will put the schools on the right track. Boyd Boda gave this conviction support when, in discussing fascism and communism in his book, Democracy as a Way of Life, he said of these doctrines that each provided a comprehensive plan for the organization of both individual and collective conduct, which is essentially what is meant when we speak of a way of life. The title of his volume, Democracy as a Way of Life, gives evidence that its author, devoted as he was to the rights of free men, was concerned to show the superiority of the democratic way of life in contrast to the patterns of fascism and communism. He did show this, yet he left a question with me that I still find bothersome. In what sense is democracy a way of life? In what sense, indeed, is communism a way of life? Is the latter, communism, more than the lengthened shadow of the leader's whip? Do we mean that each has an internal substance that all who live in relationship to grasp and understand? If so, neither qualifies as a way of life. Was communism equally communism under Lenin and Stalin? Is it now the same way of life under Malenkov? Was democracy not democracy before women were granted the vote? And what of our way of life when it was legal to conduct segregated schools? Was our way of life more in evidence on the frontier when the individual took the law in his own hands? At what point do we stop and say, there it is, have a go at it? Was democracy non-existent when unions were unheard of? Is our way of life more in evidence now that the stock market is watched by government than when bullish and bearish movements were its private business? And who among us is our authority? Historian, politician, businessman, churchman, educator, farmer, miner, or factory worker? What then is in conflict when we speak of competing and conflicting ways of life? Do we select a single feature, say the two-party system, or a central tendency, say belief in a divine being, or an historic fact, say a general dependence on individual initiative in economic matters, as our point of contrast? Now, I recognize that our past has given us preferences in the realms of social and individual values. It has given us opportunities, too. I can swell with appropriate pride when I think of these. I recognize further that some of these values are not prized by all others in the world, and that when others threaten them, we value them more intensely. This latter fact is inescapable, and it is good that this is so. Bode was not wrong in insisting that the commonly shared values in a culture give life its meaning and purpose. I am not happy over the prospect, however, that some among us may come up with a delineation of the democratic way of life at a moment when a pervading anxiety provides a power opportunity which will end speculation for the rest of us. If this happens, the problem of educating for democracy will be solved. Schools will be used to assure continuity for the newly developed power, and while a way of life may seem to prevail, democracy will be but a facade for authoritarianism, obscuring the motives of those who manipulate the controls in the back room. This sad ending was not envisaged by Boyd Bode. Far from it. His was a blow struck against authoritarianism, against, as far as schools were concerned, indoctrination in any form. As he put it, democratic education is obligated to stake everything on a program for the liberation of intelligence. It need not and must not demand uniformity of belief. Pupils come to school with all kinds of backgrounds. It is hardly conceivable that they should all emerge with the same set of conclusions. It is not to such uniformity of conclusion, but to certain habits of thinking and feeling and acting that democracy must look as its hope for the future. He held that the democratic school could make an honest disclaimer of any intention of predetermining the patterns of belief young people would achieve in an education appropriate to the democratic way of life. He equally held, however, that the democratic school should help young people achieve understanding of the values they hold simply by having been born among us, that it should help them think through the conflicts which arise when such values are compared and contrasted, and that its continuing obligation was to help the young person at each stage of his development advance his understanding of that which was distinctively democratic in the human relationship. Unless the next generation can do a better job than we have done, he insisted, the values of our civilization will be seriously endangered. The student is entitled to have all the light that the school can furnish on underlying issues, and he should have the opportunity for the exercise of enlightened and independent judgment. My question arises because the phrasing, a way of life, is used loosely. At times, we refer to a belief which holds that each individual should develop his own values and learn to use them as the means of gaining meaning and purpose for his daily living. We recognize that this is an individual matter, that democracy provides each individual with this opportunity and privilege. At other times, however, what we refer to is an individual perception of democracy that we have staked out as a way of life into which the immature individual should be inducted. I don't believe we can have it both ways. If the latter meaning is at issue, the former meaning is denied. If we know in advance what the democratic way of life is, we are acting wastefully, if not dangerously, when we permit each individual to formulate his Weltanschauung independently. Moreover, if we know in advance what this way of life is, we shall have little further need for the free-ranging intelligence, the play of idea upon idea, the give and take of discussion and conference as differences are explored, or the achievement of compromises as understanding is substituted for force, all qualities which have characterized our past. For my own part, I prefer to leave the problem of a way of life in the hands of each individual, helping him to be sure, but leaving it up to him to choose, to judge, and to reach that stage of reflection which gives him finally his personal character. This, I am sure, was finally Botha's position, despite an emphasis that some may misuse in their anxiety to assure democracy's survival. I believe, too, it was John Dewey's position, though the emphasis in the first sentence that follows may cast a doubt. Dewey said, "We have advanced far enough to say that democracy is a way of life. We have yet to realize that it is a way of personal life and one which provides a moral standard for personal conduct. On the personal level, we can discuss differences. We can accommodate ourselves one to the other in terms of our dispositions and our tolerances. We can create the social instruments, as we have already done in part, to facilitate our relationships and to extend the range of our common interests and understandings. We can, at short, come at life in ways that involve each of us responsibly in determining the shape of things to come without giving to any of us the privilege of doing the final shaping. Democratic principles are involved, of course, in what is here suggested, and these did not come out of the blue. They have been developed over the years as men have struggled with others and with themselves to find and to maintain ways of living together that would make the burdens of life more tolerable. To question the usefulness of referring to democracy as a way of life, so far as the conduct of education is concerned, is not to question the distinctiveness of democracy. Ways of life are surely involved in democracy. A way of life is not. I'm reminded of a discussion some years back, initiated because of the publication of a volume, Puritanism and Democracy, written by Ralph Barton Perry of Harvard, in which a reviewer of this volume in Time magazine, it was almost 10 years ago to this day, said that this book had demonstrated where the essential faith of America came from the Puritans. And a professor at Rice Institute in Texas, George Guyon Williams, was somewhat irritated by this statement, and he wrote the following letter to the editors of Time. This is what he said, "Sirs, in reviewing Professor Ralph Barton Perry's Puritanism and Democracy, you say, the essential faith of America came into being in the cold, clear-headed, spacious world of Puritan New England. Can you really believe that? I myself have always believed that Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry, and James Monroe, Virginians all, had some small part in establishing the essential faith of America. And the Jamaica-born Alexander Hamilton of New York, the illiterate pirate Andrew Jackson of Tennessee, the ribald Abraham Lincoln of Kentucky and Illinois, the uncouth Walt Whitman of Brooklyn, did these have no part in the work? And are you aware that self-government, by means of popularly chosen representatives, had its beginnings in Virginia under Governor Yardley in 1619, nearly 2 years before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, and 11 years before the Puritans arrived? The essential faith of America? There are a dozen essential faiths. From New England may have come our faith in good morals, but New York gave us our tolerance. Pennsylvania, our faith in justice. The South, our proud independence. The Middle West, our practical realism. The Far West, our belief in the impossible. Spice all this with a flavor of cynicism and humanitarianism from the Jews, humor and hot-headedness from the Irish, sex and sophistication from the French, and sentimentality and love of comfort from the old-fashioned Germans, and you have a rough outline of essential Americanism. It is a lot bigger than anything that ever happened in poor little New England. Now, it seems to me that what we need to emphasize is the quality that pervades the human relationship, because certain principles of relationship are at issue. Respect for the individual person. Respect for ideas that individuals generate. Respect for decisions taken jointly. Respect for law, as this is hammered out on the anvils of interpretation, that respect both the individual and the need for social controls in order that individual respect may be maintained. Respect for legislation that seeks to equalize opportunity both at the beginning and at the end of life. These are among the working principles of those who take democracy seriously. As principles, they help men discover ways, better ways, of conducting the human relationship. They do not, being principles, underwrite what the specific ways are to be. It is the function of shared intelligence to make this discovery as we move from situation of relationship to situation of relationship. Our principles help us in our valuing. They provide us with bases of judging how better to organize our lives. They function as dynamic instruments that keep us coming at life democratically. What they add up to, indeed, is a way of coming at life. And this, as I see it, is just what democracy, over and beyond its more limited political meaning, connotes: a way of coming at life so that each individual and each idea may have an opportunity to be heard in situations of tolerance and understanding, providing us thus with a normal sense of progressively extending the baseline of our common interest, the ever-present democratic concern. An education designed for democracy, then, should exemplify all of the flexibility, all of the tolerance, which democratic principles demand, if it is to be free of dogma or of routine practice. No school of thought has an inherent right to take education over. No specified body of subject matter will guarantee its success. No single methodology will of itself transform it from an authoritarian operation into a democratic one. We argue over the wrong things. Instead of examining the consequences of our actions to see what qualities of democratic relationships they advance and in what degree, we quarrel about the validity of the prospectus we propose. Thus, some say that all who believe in absolute standards are undemocratic, that all who believe in organized subject matter are authoritarian. Others reverse the picture, saying that those who do not believe in absolute standards are irresponsible, that those who turn to interest and need in building the curriculum are barbaric. All use labels too freely. The test lies in the consequences of the teacher-student relationship, in the meaningful quality of the learning situation which results, in the spirit that pervades the total undertaking. I happen to believe, for instance, that men have progressively built up the principles that guide them in their behavior, and that this is a never-ending process. Yet I know those who believe are directing principles to be absolute, and though they are surely wrong, they are good men. They believe that life is somehow fulfilled for them by their sense that what they take to be personally true and good has objective status in the universe at large. They believe in democracy, I discover, quite as much as I do. And their desire to achieve it for all men is no less than mine. Are we then to part company when we turn to the task of education? I don't think so. I do think we might properly part company, with the parting being initiated from either quarter, if one were to discover that the other mistreated students by denying them the right to become persons in the only way that they can, by doing their own choosing, their own judging, their own thinking. Life would be simplified if we could tell from the reading of an individual's philosophical and pedagogical credentials what consequences would follow his entry into the classroom. But life is not this neat, and we shall have to continue to reach our judgments by evaluating the quality of the intellectual and human enterprise which results as the Teaching Learning Act is initiated and maintained. It is here, if any place, that we may gain evidence on which to establish preferences for curriculum patterns, for methods of teaching, or for purposes. If we come at education democratically, we shall be patient with those who differ with us, more tolerant of their deviations. If we come at education democratically, we shall share as our common holding the values and the principles by which free men may create an enriched life in which all may participate with dignity, and through education may create future citizens who possess the techniques and the temper to carry this life forward.
You have been listening to H. Gordon Hullfish, professor of education at Ohio State University, speaking on the subject, Educating for Democracy. Next week, our speaker will be Albert Deutsch, author and journalist. His topic, Public Responsibility for Police Corruption. Listen each week at this time to Morals and Politics, a tape-recorded series of programs from the Cooper Union Forum, presented by the National Association of Educational Broadcasters in cooperation with the Cooper Union and radio station WNYC, New York City. This is the NAEB Radio Network.